Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. With me today are Hannah Jewell from Glenwood Springs High School and Sabrina Turbidy from Aspen High School, both rising seniors. They will be interviewing Kevin Flaherty from Williams College, Massachusetts. Kevin began his career with an undergraduate degree from the University of Rochester, followed by a PhD in astronomy from the University of Arizona. After working on the James Webb Space Telescope instrument, he returned to the Northeast as a postdoctoral researcher at Wesleyan University and has just joined Williams Astronomy and Physics Department as the observatory manager and astronomy lab instructor. In his research career, he's focused on the structure of gas and dust surrounding young stars and how planets form out of this material. He's also interested in making astronomy a more inclusive environment and in bringing astronomy to others through outreach in the community. That's why we've got him here today. When he's not working on astronomy, Kevin enjoys cooking, hiking, and playing Frisbee.
Hi, I was wondering, how did you decide that you wanted to take this career path and get an undergraduate degree in this subject?
Yeah, so thinking back on my career in astronomy, my interest in astronomy has been there basically my entire life. I mean, as far back as I can remember, I always thought space was cool. You know, everything in space, stars, planets, galaxies were always really exciting. And even when I talked to people who knew me when I was, you know, knee-high to a grasshopper, they're like, oh yeah, this guy was always interested in astronomy. So going into college, I knew that I wanted to study astronomy. So I grew up in upstate New York, so I went to a college that was not too close to my parents, but not too far away either. And you know, I studied astronomy there, and then I knew I wanted to go to grad school in astronomy. And then from there, it was just kind of following a career path that continued in astronomy, doing the things that I really enjoy.
So you just recently moved to Williams College on June 1st, I think you said?
July 1st.
July 1st. Ooh, wow. Even closer. So we were wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about Williams College. Where is it? Why did you recently decide to move there? What new discoveries are you planning on making at this college? And anything else you wanted to include about it?
Yeah, so for those of you that don't know, Williams College is a small liberal arts college in the Northeast. It's in northwestern Massachusetts. It's about a three-hour drive from Boston. It's, you know, buried in the Berkshire Mountains, so you can have surrounded by hills, you know, similar to Aspen, but the mountains aren't quite as tall. And I recently moved there. You know, I was there before. I was at Wesleyan University, which is also a small liberal arts college in the Northeast. It's in central Connecticut. And the reason I moved there was because the position at Wesleyan University actually ended. So the typical career path for astronomers is, you know, you go and get a PhD, and then you move on to postdoctoral positions. These are temporary positions, maybe 3 to 5 years in length. A lot of them are government funded or university funded. So basically what happened was, you know, I went to grad school at the University of Arizona. I went to Wesleyan University for this postdoc. It was 5 years long, and then the funding ran out. So I had to find another job. And I had known Williams College since it was in the area. I knew the people there. So they had this job ad for available. So I applied there. I got the job. I'm really excited about it. You know, as you said, I started on July 1st. So I was there all of 2 weeks before I came out to Aspen for 2 weeks. So I can't tell you what the I can tell you what the job description is, but I can't tell you the day-to-day life yet. But I'm excited because it's you know, it's not the quite big universities. It's not the Harvard, Caltechs, Princeton's type of places. I'm really excited about this because you get to know the students really well. You know, you see them come in as freshmen and grow over the 4 years of their college career. And then you see them go on and do other things. So my job is, you know, helping the students in the labs, helping them use the telescopes. We have a half-meter telescope on top of the science building, so I'll be running that. All of the students who take an astronomy class go through that telescope. So it's really kind of introducing astronomy to those students, you know, both the majors and non-majors, that I'm really excited about.
Okay. And speaking of the telescope, you were working on the James Webb Space Telescope for 2 years. What did that work consist of?
Yeah, so this was at the end of my PhD before I got to Wesleyan University. This was, so the James Webb Space Telescope is a 6-meter space telescope. It's the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, and it has a couple of different instruments on it. The instrument that I worked on in particular is called NIRCam. It stands for Near Infrared Camera. So not super creative, but it helps you know what it is. And it was just at the phase where they were building the camera and they were doing all these testing on it. So I was brought in to help with that testing. This testing took place on, I think it was Lockheed Martin in California, who was building the instrument and doing all the testing. So we had to fly out to California. The testing you have to do is in this cryogenic chamber because they have to keep the instrument very, very cold. And it's designed to work in space where it's very, very cold. So in order to test it, you have to get it to the temperature of in space. So you'd fly out there. These tests were run 24 hours a day for, you know, weeks or months at a time. So it'd be going out there and be testing every little thing you could possibly think of about this camera. Because when a telescope is in space, you can't go up there and fix it outside of Hubble. Like, you know, once it's there, it's there.
Yeah.
So you have to make sure it works before it gets there. So it's a lot of little things. It's let's turn the filter wheel to the left one spot. Now let's turn it to the left two spots. Now let's turn it to the left three spots. Now let's turn it to the right one spot. But you have to do that. And so that's what I was brought in and kind of getting to know the instrument and helping build it up so that we know it works.
Okay. And is this telescope taking photos of the dust particles that are outside the young stars? Is that correct? I don't know.
That's absolutely right. So James Webb Space Telescope has a lot of really broad science goals. Mm-hmm. One of them is studying these cradles of planets. And one of the particular things it's really good at is looking at infrared wavelengths. So our eye is sensitive to optical light, but if you go just redder than that, you get into the infrared. That's really important for looking for dust because there's this kind of general principle that the heat of something determines the wavelength that it emits at. Mm-hmm. So you think of our sun, very, very hot object, 6,000 degrees. It emits a lot of light in the optical, which is what our eyes are good at seeing. Something like you or me at this table is a lot colder than that, maybe a few hundred degrees. It still emits light, but it's now in the infrared. That's what kind of night vision goggles that work in the infrared can see that sort of thing. Now, if we look at the dust around young stars, it's also very cold. It can be maybe 1,000 Kelvin. It can go all the way down to 20 Kelvin. So now, you know, if you look in the infrared, you're more sensitive to that cold dust without seeing as much from the star. So that's why it's really powerful, this near-infrared camera, the near-infrared spectroscopy, all the sorts of things, because it's really sensitive to the wavelengths at which the dust is emitting around these stars.
So how is what you've seen from these telescopes, how has that shaped your understanding about how stars are made and planets and stuff like that?
So I spent this part of my career working on James Webb Space Telescope. The last couple of years, I've actually been working on radio wavelengths. So very much, much longer wavelengths, probing still similar environments, but different type of dust, larger dust grains further from the star. And there we're really undergoing a transformation in our understanding of these systems. And that's why, you know, this conference here at Aspen has been such an exciting thing. And one of the amazing things we've been seeing is, you know, if you had asked me 10 years ago, what's the structure of a disk? I would say, well, it's relatively smooth. You know, there's lots of material close in, and then it kind of smoothly decreases as you go further out. And with this radio telescope down in Chile, the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, ALMA, we're seeing that it's really not smooth at all. It, like, none of the disks that we've looked at with enough detail show any smooth structure. It's all these narrow gaps or narrow rings, you know, some close in, some further out, just all these completely different structures that we were not expecting. And this is something that's really changing the field over the past couple of years and really changing our entire view of these disks. Because we used to think, oh, these are the sites where planets might form eventually. But now we're saying, well, maybe planets have already formed and we're just catching, you know, the end cycle of that whole process.
And how does the light pollution affect your pictures or like view of these events happening?
It's a good question. It depends on a number of different things. So let's see. So light pollution, you kind of think of streetlights, that sort of thing. That can be kind of a problem if you're looking in the optical. I certainly remember in Arizona, when I was working there, one of the telescopes was kind of southwest of Tucson. And Phoenix, which is farther from this telescope than Tucson is, you could actually see the kind of glow on the horizon from Phoenix and Tucson as well. So it was always a little bit of a problem when you were out there. And that's part of the reason that the sites where we build these telescopes are very, very remote places. Mauna Kea in Hawaii is one common place you see a number of telescopes because there isn't a whole lot of light pollution. This radio telescope I talked about is down in Chile, the northern part of Chile in the Atacama Desert, where there's, you know, no other cities around. And it also helps that you're in the radio, so you don't see kind of street lights. There's also one place that I visited recently is Green Bank, West Virginia. This is a radio telescope that's 100 meters in diameter. It's a single dish that's a football field across. So it's absolutely enormous. And what they worry about a lot is radio interference from cell phones, from Wi-Fi, from all sorts of things. So it's actually a national radio quiet zone. So when you're driving down there, you start 30 miles away and your cell phone stops working. And you walk up to the site and there's absolutely no Wi-Fi anywhere near that, which is kind of a weird thing to kind of visit because you're not used to it. But it's interesting, you know, you go and have dinner with these people and you realize no one's checked their cell phone the entire time. It's kind of nice.
Especially in this generation, it's hard to find.
Absolutely, yeah.
Looking at these stars, how can you tell the difference between like a newborn star and an older star, like to find your research and stuff?
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, the first step you have to do is you have to find all these new young stars before you can study the disks around them.
Yeah.
So one thing is if they have a disk or not. If we can see, you know, the infrared or radio light from dust surrounding this young star, the star, then we know it's pretty young because we only see that sort of thing almost exclusively when they're young. Another thing we can look for is we know these stars form out of giant clouds of molecular gas. So there are surveys that look for these clouds of molecular gas, and then we'll come back and we're like, okay, let's find all the stars in this particular region of the sky. If you're familiar with the constellation of Orion, Orion's Sword is one of the more famous regions of star formation because there's just a huge amount of molecular gas emission. And then when we zoom in, we see a ton of young stars there as well. Mm-hmm. So let's see, you look for the molecular clouds, X-ray emission is another good way to look for young stars. This is very, very high energy emission. You know, the surfaces of these stars, we imagine we have sunspots on our sun, we have kind of solar flares. Young stars are like that, but times 10 or times 100. So those flares create this really high energy emission, and that's what we can see with X-rays. So that's how we pick out these young stars. Yeah, those are kind of the most of the ways we do it.
So what are the distances you guys are dealing with? Like, what's the farthest star you guys are looking at right now?
That's a good question. So the type of stars that I'm looking at are tend to be kind of the biggest and brightest disks. So it's, you know, not representative, but it's a starting point. So there we're dealing with things. I think the closest I've dealt with is about 150 light years away, and the farthest is about 450 light years away. Wow. So the Orion star forming region is actually closer to it's closer to 1,000 light years away. It's over 1,000 light years away. And that's, you know, a distant, relatively star forming region. But there are star forming regions throughout our galaxy. I mean, this is a tiny piece of our galaxy that we've surveyed for all this star formation because it's really hard to see things on the other side of the galaxy. We know the center of the galaxy is 24,000 light years away for reference. So if we're only seeing star forming regions that are 1 or 2,000 light years away, we're really just probing our neighborhood.
And I know there's the Orion Nebula. Mm-hmm. So are there a lot of young stars in that area? Or like, how do you differentiate between nebulas, stars, planets, galaxies? How do you pinpoint each one?
Yeah, all the difference between nebulas and galaxies is a really interesting question. Because if you go back in the history of astronomy in the early 1900s, people didn't know the difference between those two. There was this, we call it the great debate in astronomy, because people were actually debating, you know, these nebulas that we see, which were at that point were just kind of fuzzy things that they could see through the telescope. Are they things within our own galaxy or are they other galaxies entirely? Like, we didn't have the information on the distances that well to tell if they were that far away. The telescopes weren't that powerful. So, you know, that was a debate. We didn't have any idea. And then we kind of figured out distance is a little bit better, some of the motions within these systems, and we realized a lot of these fuzzy blobs were other galaxies. We can distinguish galaxies from kind of the Orion Nebula just because they look very different on the sky. galaxies look, for the most part, like little clumps of stars. Sometimes they're really flat, like spiral galaxies, or maybe they're just kind of giant balls, like elliptical galaxies, or maybe they're very irregular. Mm-hmm. But that looks very different than something like the Orion Nebula, which has a lot of gas, a lot of dust, and then just some stars spread throughout there.
You said it was harder for you to study these galaxies because you're only in this tiny little area within our galaxy and you can't see very far away as of now. How do you plan on changing that in the future? How do we plan on seeing farther and farther into this galaxy or different galaxies, just everywhere in the universe? How do we plan on seeing farther out?
So one thing I can say that's come out really recently is this European spacecraft called Gaia. And what this spacecraft has done is it's measured distances to billions of stars, which is really, they've only released their data in the past year, and this has really transformed our understanding of how far away these things are. So we used to say, you know, Orion is like 1,000 light years plus or minus 200, which is not a great uncertainty, but now we can go in and we can see individual stars and say, what are the distances to 1% errors, or even less than that. So that's really helping us, and that'll tell us when we start to look at star-forming regions that aren't within 1,000 light years, that are maybe 3,000 or 4,000 light years away, we'll have a better idea of exactly how far away they are, because we know about those star-forming regions, but they haven't been studied as well. So we'll be pushing deeper. Now that we know distances, we can push deeper that way. The other big challenge is sensitivity. So if you take an object that we look at that's, you know, 100 light years away, and you put it 10 times further away, now it's 100 times fainter. So now you need to observe for 1,000 times longer with your telescope. So your 1 hour observation is now a week. Mm-hmm. So that makes it a lot harder, but you still can compare some things. So I know there are some efforts to kind of look at what a star formation look like in nearby galaxies or even distant galaxies, and very broadly compare that what we see locally. So we use the Orion Nebula as a standard point. We say, okay, that's the nearest really big star-forming region that we see. Now let's look at in the nearest galaxies and look at their big star-forming regions. And do they look like Orion? Do they look different? Do they have more things like that?
And you briefly touched on uncertainty. How do you minimize? Because personally, in IB Physics, we have a real struggle with minimizing the human error or random error and statistical error. So, like, how do you minimize that to get the most precise and efficient data?
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time worrying about this. Mm-hmm. So my main research topic now is trying to measure turbulence in the disks around young stars. And what we're finding is we're not measuring a lot of it. We're putting upper limits on it. So this gets at the exact question of uncertainty. What is the exact upper limit that you can put on this, which requires a really good knowledge of what's the uncertainty on all these different factors? And some of it is, you know, uncertainty in the data. You get a certain number of photons from your disk. If you get more photons, it's always better. So we try to kind of maximize that. But then there are other systematic things. We really need to know the temperature of the gas very well, because if we don't, then we won't know the turbulence very well. Yeah. So it's, okay, are there ways that we can measure the temperature that are independent of the ways that we're measuring the turbulence? So that's one way we can do it, kind of combine independent measurements of these things together to form this. And we also use a lot of advanced for astronomers, statistical techniques. I do a lot of stuff with Bayesian statistics and Markov chain Monte Carlo. Mm. So this is a way of accounting for the uncertainties within the data and folding that into assumptions within the model to try to translate that into an uncertainty in the final number of turbulence.
Adding on to my uncertainty question, mm-hmm. In science, there's always uncertainty with everything we do. For instance, like the geocentric model, like that ended up being proved false. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with things being proved false or adding on to a theory that could end up being incorrect? How do you tackle those obstacles?
So let me go back. I mentioned that our understanding of disks is rapidly changing. We used to think they were smooth, but now we see all these sorts of different structures. So now if you were to go look at papers that were written 5 or 10 years ago that made the assumption that disks were really smooth, you know, you could look at it and be like, oh, let me just throw it out because it's all wrong. But there's still a lot of good stuff in there. Kind of the size of the disks maybe that they measured is still right. The amount of photons that they measured, that's certainly still accurate. Yeah. So what's changing is not so much the raw numbers that you get from the telescope, it's your interpretation, it's your understanding of what those numbers mean in terms of a physical structure. And I think that's definitely part of the process of science, is this constantly changing, you know, underlying view of what's actually happening in the universe. So it's a, you know, it's a reinterpretation of some of the things that we've seen before in light of new ideas and that sort of thing. So the science is definitely on this arc of, like, we're constantly kind of bending towards reality and with some deviations, but we eventually, we're kind of getting there slowly.
What current projects are you working on right now, being in Aspen? Obviously, there's no telescopes nearby. What have you been working on?
So I'm working on a couple of different projects when I'm here. It's, you know, I had a very ambitious schedule. I've gotten through, I think, 30% of it, which is a pretty good number. So one of them, I mentioned measuring turbulence in these young disks. So I have, you know, data for three disks in addition to the two that I had measured previously. So it's trying to write up those results. It's, you know, nailing down, like you said, the uncertainties. Do I know really well what's the upper limit on two of them and what's the detection on the other one? So it's writing that up. There was another project going back to my days as a grad student studying infrared observations of these disks. One of the cool things that we saw was that the infrared light, the number of photons we get, changes rapidly with time, like in the course of a few hours or weeks or days or months. But we don't know why that is. You know, it's something about these disks are changing, but the only information we have is they get brighter and fainter. So it's kind of this fun puzzle to understand what's going on. So I have some data sets from the Spitzer Space Telescope measuring what is the light curve, that kind of how does the brightness of these stars change with time, and pulling information out of that to understand what's the structure of these systems.
What have you been doing to try and put this into the public?
Well, I guess there are two different pieces of that. There's making astronomy more inclusive and then bringing it to the public.
Yeah.
So I'll start with the inclusive part. So astronomy, like most sciences, is biased in terms of its demographics. For specifically astronomy, it's 70% male and over 80% white. But there's absolutely no evidence that white men are better at astronomy than anyone else. So this is a problem that, you know, certainly astronomy faces, all sorts of sciences face this at varying levels. So it's taking a lot of work to try to understand, where do these biases come from? How do you end up with this skewed demographics, and what can we do about this? So one of the things I actually did at Wesleyan was led a discussion once a month where we talked about these issues using a lot of kind of published research on where this can kind of come from. But, you know, get people, science faculty, science students together to talk about, oh, here's this, you know, National Academies just published this report on sexual harassment in sciences. Let's talk about what they found. Let's talk about some of the suggestions they have for how to fix this problem. And let's see if we can implement that and kind of change our culture on a long term. So that's, you know, that's, again, it's a long term change. It's, you know, it's not going to happen overnight, but if you get enough people together pushing on this, and, you know, I'm building on a lot of work by a lot of other people in astronomy. There's a lot of the American Astronomical Society has done a lot of work for pushing towards making astronomy more inclusive, and I'm just adding my one little piece on top of that. So that's for inclusivity. For outreach, there's a number of different things I've done. It's, you know, I really enjoy, especially working with elementary age schools, elementary school students. They are incredibly enthusiastic. They're incredibly excited about science, and they're really smart. They know so much about this material. One of the things I did when I was in Arizona was, you know, I worked with a first grade classroom, go visit them once or twice or three or four times a year, and go teach them about the scale of the solar system, about constellations and everything like that. And they are just incredibly enthusiastic. And I love being able to introduce astronomy to them and kind of build that up. Maybe they'll become astronomers or scientists someday.
Awesome. Well, speaking of students, what are some pieces of knowledge that you would like to give the younger students, like high schoolers, middle schoolers, even elementary school kids? Like, what would you recommend for kids who, like, want to go into astronomy or science?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess the biggest piece of advice is that, you know, it's going to feel like, when you look at kind of other people around doing science, it's going to feel like, oh, everyone's smarter than I am. But it's not actually true. I would, you know, encourage people to kind of always work hard and always kind of push through the things that they think are challenging, because like when you hit that wall where you're like, oh, I don't understand anything anymore, that means that you're learning something. So you've hit the edge of your knowledge, but now you're going to push past that edge. So that's really important. And everyone kind of hits that barrier at different points, but being able to push through that barrier is a really big part of being a scientist, being able to hit those walls and go through it. Yeah. And then going back to the, you know, looking around at other people and they always look smarter than you. When I was looking at the list of, you know, previous podcasts that had been done for this, and I like looked through all the scientists and I was like, oh my God, they're all smarter than me. Why did they ask me to do this? Yeah. So it's, I mean, it happens to everyone, this imposter syndrome. So, you know, it's not unique. It has nothing to do with how smart you are. You know, just kind of push through that and do it. Go from there.
Thank you very much, Kevin Flaherty from Williams College, and Hannah Jewell from Glenwood Springs High School, and Sabrina Turbidy from Aspen High School. Tune into Radio Physics on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 4:30. For more information about the Gopher program and events at the center, please visit the Aspen Center for Physics website at aspenphys.org or give us a call. Thank you.